I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's November 16th, and we have a lot to talk about. Some of you may be surprised to learn that magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI, has only been around since the early 1980s. Before then, getting an MS diagnosis was not nearly as reliable as it is today. MS was frequently misdiagnosed or missed completely. Today, an MRI exam is a necessary and critically important tool in diagnosing MS, following disease progression, and evaluating someone's response to their MS treatment. Recently, a team of international experts updated the MRI recommendations for people living with MS. Dr. Scott Newsom, a member of that expert panel, is joining me today to talk about some of those recommendations and to help us understand how the new recommendations will impact people living with MS. Dr. Newsom is an associate professor of neurology and the co-director of the Multiple Sclerosis Experimental Therapeutics Program at Johns Hopkins Medicine. We'll also check in with Emily Blossberg, the creator of Oscar the MS Monkey, a sock puppet who, with Emily's help, is on a mission to connect kids and teens who are living with MS with one another. And having already distributed more than 500 of Oscar's sock puppet buddies to children and teens with MS, Emily has become a real difference maker to kids diagnosed with pediatric MS. But before we get to my conversations with Emily and with Dr. Newsom, there are a few other things that you should know about. Fatigue is one of the most common MS symptoms, and it's one of those symptoms that just gets in the way of fully engaging in almost every aspect of life. Last week, the International Progressive MS Alliance hosted a webcast featuring experts who not only provided great information, but shared practical tips for managing fatigue and progressive MS. If you missed the live webcast, you still have a chance to catch the video replay, and you'll find a link to that replay in today's show notes. And since I still get email asking about this, I want to give you a quick review of the show notes for this podcast. Every episode of Real Talk MS is accompanied by show notes. That's where you'll find all the links that I refer to during the episode. It's also where you'll find timestamps for every segment of that particular episode. So if you want to share or listen to a particular news story or interview again, you'll know exactly where to find it. Here's the thing. Not every podcast app includes the show notes that accompany the podcast. And sometimes an app will include the show notes, but won't make the links clickable. So please keep in mind that you can always find complete show notes for every episode of Real Talk MS at our website at realtalkms.com. The show notes for the current week's episode are always right on the homepage. And if you click on past episodes in the menu at the top of the page, well, then you can click on any episode and not only listen to it again, but you'll also see the accompanying show notes. I hope that helps those of you who may still wonder where those show notes that I always refer to are. If you still have questions or feedback about show notes or any other aspect of Real Talk MS, please shoot me an email, DM on social media, or you can even leave voicemail on our listener hotline at area code 310-526-2283. In the United States. Although MS most commonly occurs in adults, it's also diagnosed in children and adolescents. Researchers believe that between 2 and 5% of all the people living with MS actually experience the onset of symptoms before they're 18. And today it's estimated that between 8 and 10,000 children and teens in the U.S. are living with multiple sclerosis. Odds are pretty high that when most of these children and teenagers are first diagnosed, they don't know anyone else in their circle who might be going through the same things that they are, from dealing with invisible symptoms to trying to figure out if and how to disclose their MS to their friends at school. My friend, Emily Blasberg, saw that need from a very personal perspective and decided to do something about it. And so Oscar the MS Monkey was born. Welcome back to the podcast, Emily.
It's great to be back. I love chatting with you.
I should also mention that I'm talking to you while you're attending the Consortium of MS Centers, or the CMSC annual meeting, a conference that I'm attending virtually, but you're actually there. So what's it like being face-to-face again with others who've elected to attend the conference in person?
It's re-energizing. You know, as hesitant as we were to come, there are so many safety precautions in place, which is great. But as we arrived at the hotel yesterday, I was just filled with so much excitement because we're back and we're showing the MS community that our organization is stronger than ever. And there's just a sense of a little bit more normalcy, which is nice, and being able to see some familiar faces and make those new connections is really great.
We've talked about this before on the podcast, but for the benefit of our newer listeners, can you tell us what Oscar the MS Monkey is all about?
I'll start with a little background on my story. So I was diagnosed with MS when I was 15 years old. And my symptoms started when I was 14. And one of my favorite hobbies has always been to knit. When my symptoms started at 14, the yarn running across my fingers as I was knitting was really painful. And so I had to stop knitting, but I had to keep my hands busy with something. And so I started making sock monkeys instead. And fast forward a bit, I made this orange sock monkey for myself and started bringing them to different MS functions as a way of telling my story. You know, I used to knit and now I make sock monkeys. And that's because of my MS diagnosis. The yarn was sensitive on my skin and the socks feel better. And then he just started taking on his own his own mission of, it started with telling my story, but then it turned into, how do we connect other kids who have MS? When I was first diagnosed, I went to the MS Society and I said, can you connect me with all the other kids and teenagers in my area? And they said, we'd love to, we want to, but we don't know of anybody else your age. And I knew that I couldn't be the only kid out there with MS. And it wasn't until another year later that I found someone who lives about 400 miles away from me, and we connected. And that connection was so powerful because she understood what I was going through, and no one else had that, or no one else I knew could create that connection, which, as I said, it was just really powerful. And I wanted to be able to make sure that other kids and teenagers had that. They didn't have the loneliness that's involved with the pediatric MS diagnosis. They had the connection and the friendship and the support. And so that's why our organization was started, as a resource for pediatric MS. And now it's evolved into so much more. Even since the last time we spoke, we have grown our program so much, and it's exciting.
Tell me what happens when a kid or a teenager reaches out to Oscar the MS Monkey for the first time.
So our first program, when a kid reaches out, or a parent or a kid at heart, is we send them one of Oscar's buddies. And Oscar's buddies is they're smaller versions of Oscar. They're a handmade sock monkey. We dye the socks ourselves so that they're all our own color, which is great. And we ask them to send a picture of us, or a picture to us of them and their buddy, and then post it online. And it's a way of kids being able to see that community, that I have MS, I have one of these buddies. There's a picture of another kid holding a buddy. They have MS too. We have that connection. We have that similarity. And it's a way of bringing community together. And that's how that was our first program. And to date, we've sent over 500 buddies across the world to kids with MS.
That's incredible. So what sort of activities do you and Oscar's other buddies participate in?
Through a lot of discussion with kids and teenagers who have MS. We have grown our programs. We now have a teen camp for teenagers ages 13 to 18. We have a young adult retreat for those who have aged out of our teen camp because they all still want to come to camp, but they've aged out. And we have a family camp, which we call our Buddy Bash. Our first year, we had 3 families attend. Our second year, 6. And our third year, we had 13 families. So we were doubling every year, which is also great.
Well, that was really encouraging to hear that you've opened up your camp to young adults who refuse to leave. I have to tell you that personally, I'm waiting for you to open up Oscar's programs to the old adults so I can come to camp as well. In the meantime, I'm curious, have you seen the COVID-19 pandemic have any sort of effect on the kids and the teens involved in Oscar the MS Monkey? Have you seen it? Have they shared the way the pandemic may have changed things for them?
Absolutely. So at the very beginning of the pandemic, all of our teenagers, I have a group chat on text message that was started during one of our camps. And they were all texting each other saying, I really need my MS family. I need my Oscar family. Let's have a video call. And so I said, all right, let's make it happen. And for a while, we were doing daily Zoom calls, just a way of connecting with each other. It's backed off now to about twice a month, mostly because I couldn't keep up. But we, in the last 18 months, we've had almost 100 teenagers join at some point or another. And for the last few months, we have had some teenagers from Australia and Iceland joining us too. But it's definitely more of a community online, and the kids are able to see each other, even though they're not able to see each other in person, which they wouldn't really be able to do anyway because they're spread out so far across the country. Academically, also, I've heard of a lot of our kids doing fairly well with the distance learning because they can do their schooling at their own pace and they don't have to spend their energy being in a classroom with all the other distractions around them. I know that that was an experience for me as well as a middle schooler and high schooler. Being able to do some of my classes independently was really helpful because I could actually focus on my academics instead of all the other kids running around me.
Well, if someone listening might know someone who would enjoy receiving one of Oscar's buddies, what should they do?
Best ways to reach us are through Facebook. Send us a message on Facebook and we'll start a conversation about how we can get you a buddy. Or we also have our email address on our website, which is MrOscarMonkey.org.
And if some of our listeners want to further Oscar's work by making a donation, how do they do that?
First of all, we would be so grateful. All of our programs are offered free of charge and they're all funded through private donations and grants. So we would very much appreciate donations. The best way to give a donation is again through our website. You'll see a donate button on the top of the page.
Well, Emily Blossberg, thank you for giving other young people who are living with MS an opportunity to find that connection when there isn't one facing them at the time of their diagnosis. Please stay safe while you're at CMSC, and thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you so much, John.
In medicine, a prodrome is a sign or symptom or a set of signs or symptoms that indicates the onset of a disease before diagnostically specific symptoms develop. In MS, the prodrome would present before demyelination occurs. I find the subject of the MS prodrome to be particularly intriguing. Imagine being able to identify someone who is likely going to develop MS and proactively treating them so they never experience any MS symptoms. That sort of intervention would be life-changing. Some of you might remember that about 4 months ago, in episode 202 of Real Talk MS, I interviewed Dr. Helen Tremlett about a virtual workshop that was convened by the MS Society of Canada and the National MS Society. The workshop was focused on the multiple sclerosis prodrome. It was co-chaired by Dr. Tremlett, and the workshop participants included some of the leading MS research scientists in the world. During our conversation on the podcast, Dr. Tremlett emphasized the importance of the MS research community recognizing and further exploring the prodromal phase of MS. And last week, the MS Society of Canada, in partnership with the National MS Society, announced a study to better understand the MS prodrome. Dr. Tremlett will be heading up this study, which will use advanced machine learning techniques to examine and analyze the prodromal period by identifying predictors of MS across more than 250,000 people living in Canada and Sweden in the years before they experienced the onset of MS. As Dr. Pam Valentine, the president and CEO of the MS Society of Canada, said, "A better understanding of the prodrome means potentially delaying the onset of MS through earlier treatment, creating more targeted therapies, or even preventing it in the first place." This is pretty exciting news, and you can be sure we'll keep you updated as this work gets underway. Once MS symptoms do become apparent, it's highly likely that a neurologist will order an MRI exam to help confirm a diagnosis of multiple sclerosis. A panel of international experts has published updated recommendations for how MRI should be used in diagnosing and then treating MS. And in a moment, Dr. Scott Newsom will join us to discuss those recommendations and explain their impact on people living with MS. Magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI, has made it possible for neurologists to visualize and understand much more about MS and the underlying pathology of the disease. My guest today is Dr. Scott Newsom, Associate Professor of Neurology and the Co-Director of the Multiple Sclerosis Experimental Therapeutics Program at Johns Hopkins Medicine. And Dr. Newsom is joining me to share the updated international MRI recommendations for people living with MS. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Newsom.
Thank you.
Before we get to those new recommendations, let's cover just a couple of the basics. Can you tell us what exactly an MRI scan is and how the technology works?
Absolutely. So I'd first like to say that MRI remains the most sensitive tool that we have in MS to help aid in the diagnosis and also to monitor people over time. So it's an incredibly valuable tool that we use. And so the technology itself, how it works is it uses magnetic field and radio waves to acquire the images. And the images that are being acquired are organs and different tissues. And what I like to tell patients is that this is not radiation. So like a CAT scan where there's radiation. And this becomes important because the amount of MRI someone gets over their journey with MS can be many. But it is a really helpful technique to follow people over time, and not just to look at, is the therapy that the person's on working? Is it preventing new spots on MRI? Is it preventing new contrast-enhancing lesions? But also, from a surveillance safety imaging perspective, you know, that brain infection, PML, and other infections that people may get or could get as it relates to their MS therapy, you know, MRIs are very helpful in monitoring for that as well.
Well, as I mentioned when I introduced you, we have these new recommendations that provide guidance on how and when to use MRI for diagnosis, prognosis, and monitoring disease treatments for people living with MS. First off, can you tell us who developed these recommendations?
Sure. It was really a group effort. NAMES, CMSC, and Magnums, which includes many dozens of people throughout the last couple of decades helped come together to put these recommendations forward. And they include clinicians like MS experts, both neurologists, neuroradiologists, also researchers. And so really a credible number of people over the years. And this is a global effort. So this is not just a US-based, North American-based. This also includes Europe and beyond. And so in order to really do right by our patients, it often starts at the MRI. How are we acquiring the proper standard of care MRIs for our patients that go beyond just the diagnosis aspect of it? So they really, it's been an awesome journey with all these people involved to put these recommendations forward.
There are basically two parts you might consider to an MRI exam. There's the part where the imaging actually takes place, and then there's the part where those images are read or interpreted. Now, is it possible that different doctors might interpret the same image differently?
Absolutely. And this comes up often, actually. Sometimes it comes up in the initial stage where you're trying to make a diagnosis of MS. And I think what often is misconstrued as an MS lesion could be a lesion related to migraine or high blood pressure or diabetes or a stroke. And so sometimes there's confusion on whether someone actually has MS because they have nonspecific neurological symptoms and these white matter lesions. And then it becomes important over time as someone is getting their surveillance MRI after they started their treatment. Maybe they develop a new lesion and there may be some confusion or disagreement around, you know, is that new lesion really MS lesion? And maybe the therapy they're on is not working as well as we want it to, or is this a lesion that maybe is related to aging? Because we know that that does sometimes occur. And so what I encourage people to do is be very open and candid with your clinician. If you read on a report that there's a new lesion present or not, talk to your clinician about the MRI. And also, you know, well, at least where I am, we can ask for second opinions on MRIs. Like if there was an MRI done on the outside, we'll have our neuroradiologists actually review the images, which they're individuals that have, more expertise in reading neurological imaging techniques. And then I look at my MRIs of my patients. And, you know, I think it's important for the clinician also to look at it.
How often do these new recommendations, do they provide guidance on how often someone who's living with MS should get an MRI?
Yeah, so this is where it's there's a lot of detail within the recommendations that are published, but the high points. So if someone is newly diagnosed with relapsing remitting multiple sclerosis, they have usually that baseline MRI, which is what, you know, got them their diagnosis. And then after starting treatment, we usually like to get an MRI based on the consensus 3 to 6 months out from starting that medication. And that helps us determine whether we're happy with whether the medication is working or not. Are there new lesions showing up? You know, are those lesions contrast enhancing? Because that makes a difference early on. And then, you know, over time, if we feel like the person's doing well on the medication, they're stable clinically, no relapses, their exam looks good, then we can space out the amount of time in between these MRIs. And usually the first few years, we do like to do it yearly. But then after that, many clinicians will recommend even doing it every other year, the MRI. If, let's say, the person's on a treatment that is not associated with that brain infection PML. And also, and sort of the attack on to that, there are some patients that I see that are now in their 60s and 70s who have been on treatment. Maybe it's one of the old injectable therapies that don't have that risk of PML or another infection associated with it. And I've said to them, well, it's been a decade. You've done so well. Let's continue your medication. But I don't think we need to repeat your MRI anymore unless something comes up. But I will say it's a case-by-case scenario. We have to look at each individual to determine these recommendations that are put forward, you know, what can we use for each person that we see?
Can you share with us what this updated brain and spinal cord MRI protocol now includes?
Absolutely. So there's a few different components. So first, as you mentioned, brain and spine. So you need to know what part of the body and what part of the nervous system you're going to image. And it sounds silly to hear that, but you know, there are some occasions based on the symptoms of an individual and maybe the neurological exam that we do at the bedside tells us, well, you know, maybe we need to do a thoracic spine MRI based on what we're seeing in addition to cervical and brain MRI. So bare minimum, though, we do brain MRI and then cervical spine MRI. There's consensus on doing that up front, you know, with a newly diagnosed person. And within that, there are certain core sequences. There are several different core sequences that we feel are standard of care for our patients that help us look at the white matter lesions that we're interested in seeing. The magnet strength, you know, whether it's an open or closed MRI, we like closed MRIs because that gives better resolution of the pictures that are being acquired. And we usually will prefer a 3T magnet over 1.5T magnet strength because, again, it's higher resolution. The pictures are better. But there are some places around the world where you don't have the availability of getting a 3T magnet. So 1.5T is adequate in those scenarios. And then making sure the person stays in the same sort of radiology facility or magnet strength over time is going to be helpful. And then another thing that we really, and the consensus recommendations, and this is probably more for the radiologists and radiology facilities, is looking at slice thickness and slice gaps. In the old days when the slice thickness was like a whole loaf of bread versus one piece of toast, there was a lot of lesions that were missed. And then when we were talking about gaps, if there were a lot of gaps with the images that were being acquired, again, there were lesions that were missed. And nowadays we're trying to put forward like no gaps, minimal slice thickness. So we really can follow people closely over time and not miss anything.
You mentioned a 3T magnet and a 1.5T magnet. Can a patient ask their neurologist about the strength of the magnet?
Yeah, I actually encourage people to be an advocate for themselves, which could include just asking questions. And, you know, I would say that your clinician should not be offended by you asking questions about MRIs. And in fact, I love it when my patients ask me about the MRIs and you know, on occasion, we'll actually go through the MRIs together while we're there in clinic. And I can show them sort of what are these white spots that I'm always referring to. And so absolutely, I encourage patients to ask their clinician about the MRI. And I think the you know, standard of care for our patients has really been elevated as it relates to imaging. And we've realized, again, I think it's, you know, hindsight's always clearer, but the MRIs of the past were not capturing as much detail that we need to help take care of our patients. And so a 3T scanner, if we can get them, we love it. We want that, and we want to be consistent. If it's a 1.5, and that's the only what you can get, make sure it's a closed scanner and all those other little caveats I mentioned about slice thickness, et cetera. Definitely ask your clinician about these things.
Sometimes, but not always, the order is for an MRI with contrast. Can you talk a little bit about what gadolinium is, how it works, and what it shows in an MRI scan of someone who's living with MS?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is sort of a hot topic these days, and I think the jury's out in terms of the full safety of contrast agents. But I can say that the newer contrast agents that include gadolinium, we do feel like they are safe for people. And what gadolinium contrast does is it helps highlight T tissues and organs in a way that you can identify if a tissue or an organ is sick. And in MS, you know, a good example is when you hear your clinician talk about, oh, well, I see this lesion is enhancing. Well, what does that mean? That means that there's active inflammation, there's active demyelination occurring within that lesion, and that's not good, as one could imagine. And so the contrast agents, gadolinium contrast agents helps us identify, especially up front, how active is the MS. And then over time, especially early on in the journey with someone's MS, and especially in relapsing MS, I want to be specific, we can see more contrast enhancing lesions. And that can help determine what treatment that the person may go on up front, or if a switch in treatment is necessary because of the ongoing active inflammation we see. And John, I'll mention one other point. So contrast is very important also for non-MS related problems. So some people will have other issues that come up in life that can pick up contrast, whether it's a tumor, whether it's other inflammation within, let's say, the spine or a disc, you know, so there's a rationale for doing contrast enhanced MRIs, even if it hasn't been done for a while, but something comes up in the person's history or an exam that piques our interest to say, okay, maybe we need to add contrast to this MRI now because there's something different today than it was a couple years ago.
What do the updated international recommendations indicate about when to use or when not to use gadolinium?
Yeah, so there was a broad consensus around using gadolinium enhanced imaging at the time of diagnosis. So if someone is being worked up for multiple sclerosis and they're going to get an MRI, then doing a contrast enhanced scan is important because nowadays with our criteria that we use to make a diagnosis of MS, we can actually make a diagnosis with one clinical attack and one MRI, and of course ruling out other, you know, mimickers, and that MRI could be enhancing. So if someone has an enhancing lesion and they have a clinical attack and they've ruled out mimickers, we could say, okay, this is MS. So at the diagnosis stage, and then early on after someone starts a medication, we like to get contrast enhanced scans. And there was broad consensus there. Now, if someone's had MS for a long time and they've been stable, then the consensus is that we could likely not get contrast enhancement scans unless something comes up again that sort of is a red flag that says, okay, maybe we need to get this with contrast. In terms of the no-nos, so pregnancy. You know, a lot of our patients get pregnant during their course of their time with MS, and during pregnancy, it actually is safe to get an MRI. We usually tell people not to get an MRI, though, unless there's a clinical reason for it, but an MRI without contrast. So contrast, we know, can cross the placenta and it can affect the baby. So we tell people, nope, no contrast with pregnancy. In lactation, so a small amount of contrast does get expressed in breast milk, but not enough to where it's a complete contraindication. But I would say that many clinicians will not actually order contrast with the MRI postpartum, or they will say, okay, you know, save your breast milk, you know, before you get the MRI. Then for that 24 hours after getting contrast, get rid of your breast milk, and then you can get back to doing what you normally do. So there's a couple other caveats there, and I encourage people to look at the full recommendations to see those.
Well, I'm glad you brought up pregnancy and postpartum because, special situations in all areas of life sometimes require additional consideration. I'll ask you about one other special group. Do these new recommendations support MRI for pediatric MS patients?
They absolutely do. And in fact, the group felt strongly about most of the recommendations that we have in adults being similar in children and pediatrics. So in terms of making a diagnosis, what to image, the core sequences, in terms of follow-up MRIs over time, I would say where there's some nuances is a couple things. So in pediatrics, the current available therapies we have are limited. And so, the MRIs that are done up front may be every 6 months for a few years to really follow the child closely. And if there's new disease activity and ongoing disease activity in that short time frame, that can provide evidence to say, okay, you know what? We need to escalate or change the person to a therapy that maybe is not yet FDA approved for children. So this can build a story of why you need to switch that child to a stronger therapy. And we know that in the pediatric world up front, there's more disease activity that occurs in general. So that's why they're often done more frequently. And then also the mimickers of MS. So sometimes up front, it's very tricky to determine, does this person have MS or not? And I would say it's even trickier in the pediatric population. And so I think doing more frequent MRIs up front in children is often necessary to make sure you have the right diagnosis.
I'm not sure that anyone actually looks forward to an MRI, but I think we also realize how important that MRI exam is. So are there steps that someone can take to calm themselves and make the best of their MRI experience?
Yeah, I know it's this comes up often. And for people that have had an MRI, I have had an MRI myself, you could say it's analogous to a torture chamber where you're in this little small confined place for sometimes a couple hours. And God forbid you have to go to the bathroom. I mean, it could be quite a challenging situation. There's a few things. So some people who are severely claustrophobic, we will give them a little bit of a medication, whether it's a little bit of Valium or another calming medication prior to going into the MRI. And I usually will say, well, take it like 40 minutes before, just a pill. And then you can take a little bit extra right before you get into the MRI tube. And that actually can help quite a lot. It helps relax people. There are some facilities that will play music. So you have headphones on or earplugs that can play some nice music. Other facilities will give you just little earplugs without music, but that can help dampen down the MRI magnet noise. What I've found some people, and this may sound crazy, but they'll just pretend like they're somewhere else. They're on a beach, relaxing. And so, almost doing like a pseudo meditation while you're in the tube, and breathing exercises, if you're allowed to in the MRI tube, is sometimes helpful.
Well, Dr. Scott Newsom, thank you for all that you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/220. You'll find that link in today's show notes so you can easily copy and paste it right into your email or text. November is National Family Caregivers Month. And that feels like the ideal time to binge listen to all 8 episodes of my special podcast series, The MS Caregiver Conundrum. In those 8 episodes, you'll meet some amazing MS caregivers, each of whom occupies a slightly different caregiving role. You'll learn about some great resources for MS caregivers, and you'll hear some sobering research about caregivers. We'll even get into all the ways that public policy impacts MS caregivers. You'll find all 8 episodes of the MS Caregiver Conundrum at mscaregiverconundrum.com, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.